Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today, we're going to be talking to Bill Burke White. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our foreign correspondent here just about once a month. Welcome, Bill.
Great to be with you, as always.
So our topic for today is energy security. And energy security is something that a lot of different citizens and politicians understand in a lot of different ways, and you're here to help us make sense of it. What does energy security mean for a country that gobbles up an enormous amount of energy?
Well, I think it means a number of things, which is why it gets tossed around a lot and the term gets used in different ways. In one set of contexts, it really means the kind of geopolitics of where we get our oil and other, you know, natural resources from, and how we make sure that those resources will continue to be there for us in the future as we need them. And the term sort of started to get used, of course, when there was the oil crisis in the 1970s, and suddenly OPEC limited production and the price of oil shot up. And it's become, again, a very hot-button topic as the price of oil now has reached again near record highs and is in the upper $70 a barrel. And one starts to worry about where we're buying our oil from, how much it's going to cost, and whether we can be assured that we are going to continue to have access to it. So when we think about energy security, we think about all of those issues about price and supply and security. And now the term is also starting to get used in the context of alternate sources of energy as ways of making sure that we have energy resources available to us. And hopefully we'll be able to explore all of those issues this morning.
So where at this point in our country's history do we get our energy?
Well, once upon a time, it was very easy because there were lots of oil wells in Texas and later in Alaska that did a lot of the oil the United States needed. And many of those wells are no longer as productive as they used to be, and our demand for energy just continues to go up. And so we now tend to rely on a range of foreign suppliers as well as our own domestic sources. And those suppliers are in largest part Saudi Arabia, which is the world's currently largest oil producer, but also other countries, including Venezuela, Iraq in the past, Kuwait, and other countries in the Middle East. Of course, where countries get their energy and oil from depends in large part on geography. It is easier and cheaper for us to get oil from, say, Venezuela, that's closer, than from, say, a place like Saudi Arabia. Much of the energy resources used in Europe, which is where actually I'm talking to you from today, are coming from Russia, which is now a huge supplier of both natural gas and oil to most of the European Union. So there are now a number of countries that produce a lot of the world's oil energy, and about 40% of that oil comes today from OPEC suppliers that are part of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting States, and that seek to sort of set the prices for oil.
So it's no secret that U.S. foreign policy is in part and perhaps often large part about having relationships with these countries that assure a steady price and flow of energy, of fossil fuels.
Absolutely. And, if you look at many of the countries that we have relatively close relationships with that have nothing in common with the United States or our foreign policy values, the answer to why we've befriended them is usually oil. Perhaps the best case thereof is Saudi Arabia, a country that we could criticize for its human rights record, its democracy levels, and the way it treats its many of its own people, but yet we're extremely close to Saudi Arabia in large part because they're a major oil supplier. We have been very reluctant to criticize, say, Russia, because they now supply a great deal of the world's energy. And so on one hand, the U.S. foreign policy likes to talk in a rhetoric that says that the most important things to us are, you know, human freedom and fundamental human rights, for example. But when push comes to shove, we often tend to be driven by our need for energy and the countries that, for luck of geography and, you know, and the sort of history of, you know, of geography, where energy resources seem to have been put and can be extracted. So much of our foreign policy today does relate to that. And whatever the reasons that George Bush decided to go into Iraq, part of that was energy security. And one can debate whether it was a matter of trying to get oil into the hands of U.S. energy companies. But George Bush thought in part that we would be better off if Iraq's enormous energy resources weren't controlled by Saddam Hussein. So I think we can trace a lot of U.S. foreign policy back to this question of energy. And today, in many ways, it's coming to bite us in the rear, if I may say so. If we look at the situation in Iraq, if we look at the situation in Russia, and in countries in the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia or Iran, our foreign policy driven by energy has really done us much more harm than it has done us good.
Why did we not want to do business with Saddam Hussein, who had been an ally or at least a business partner in past years? I mean, that sounds like a question too obvious to talk about, but why could we not have a relationship that involved oil trade with this particular politician?
Well, in fact, I think that was a miscalculation on our part, in the sense that if what we really wanted was just to be able to buy oil from someone, Saddam was not the worst person in the world to buy oil from, in the sense that it was a lot easier to buy it from him than to deal with a civil war in Iraq that disrupts supplies for years to come. I think part of it, of course, was broader than just a worry that Saddam wouldn't sell us oil. He was known to be, you know, to sell to the highest bidder, not just oil, but sort of his own politics. And so I think that was part of the concern. We'd rather have a U.S.-friendly puppet regime sitting there than one that was antagonistic or hostile to the United States. And certainly Saddam had been hostile to the Bush family over the years, trying to assassinate George Bush Sr., for example. And so I think that was part of it. I also think that, you know, then there was the terrorism links and so forth that have all been proven to be faulty. But when you add the oil connection to that, I think it starts to explain why we went in to Iraq in what has now been proven to be a very misguided mission.
You said that we can debate whether the U.S. is trying to get the right to Iraqi oil. But I don't think there's a whole lot of debate to be had, is there? I mean, there have been very strong attempts on the part of the U.S. to get Iraqi law written in such a way that foreign non-Iraqi companies have access to and ownership of that oil.
So there's a couple of pieces that we should probably disentangle in thinking about this. The first is, would be, if the United States policy was simply to go and take over countries that had oil resources and claim that oil for ourselves. And that's not U.S. policy. That would not, it was not actually what was going on in Iraq. It's not that we're sitting there saying, let's invade and essentially steal the oil. The Russians have taken that approach in the last few weeks when they have gone and planted a flag on the bottom of the Arctic Ocean under the North Pole, in a sense, to try to claim the oil resources there as Russian.
By the way, the image of that is just incredible, planting a flag in underwater.
It's the old international legal rule was sort of what was known as terra nullius. If the terrain wasn't claimed, you could go and claim it. And that approach, ended in the 1700s, and the Russians seem to think it still is a viable way to stake a claim to those resources. I think largely that was an act of showmanship by Putin and an attempt to sort of have a national unity around Russia's new power in the world. But going back to your fundamental question, so if the U.S. wasn't simply trying to steal Iraqi oil, what was it trying to do? And I think part of what it was trying to do was ensure that U.S. companies, which are now really global companies, even though they may be based in the United States, had priority access to Iraqi oil. And that doesn't mean that the United States would be the only country that would be allowed to buy that oil. The oil market is entirely global, and it's a market in which there is a set price that oil trades at, and the U.S. would continue to pay that. The question is, who would reap the benefits of that? And in most countries around the world that have energy resources, they don't have the technologies and skills to extract that oil very easily. And so what you often see is partnerships between some of the major global oil companies, such as ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, British Petroleum, and others, with domestic companies that set up a profit-sharing agreement in which the foreign company that brings the technology and resources and financing gets a share, and the domestic actors get a share. And I think that's really more what we might have been trying to do in Iraq and in terms of how those laws were written, to make sure it was ExxonMobil or British Petroleum rather than, say, Gazprom, the big Russian oil company, or a Venezuelan oil company that had those rights to extract oil in Iraq. One of the things that we have seen in recent years is that the countries that have those resources are starting to demand a much greater share in the deals that they strike with the foreign companies that have the technology. And I think we were also probably trying to make sure that those contracts were negotiated in a way that was more favorable to the foreign companies than to the domestic companies. One can't say that the energy industry is all bad in this sense. There are a lot of places in the world that have great energy resources that cannot be easily extracted with local technology. So sometimes you do need the foreign partner to come in and assist the locals. But I think part of what the U.S. policy has been to try to do is get companies that we are, that are either U.S. or favorable to the U.S. to be able to take the lead in that process of energy extraction.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White. How is the Iraq war actually panning out in terms of energy security, in the context of what you're saying, for the United States?
Extremely poorly. What has happened since we began the Iraq war is that the price of oil has essentially doubled. Why did that happen? Well, it's not all to blame on the Iraq war, but certainly the fact that much of Iraq's oil production was out of commission for some time, and that questions of security of oil routes in the Persian Gulf remain very real, with a potential civil war in Iraq and uncertainty with Iran. That has certainly driven up questions in regard to the supply of oil and pushed the price up. Simultaneously, I think what has happened is that the world has realized that the demand for oil may be, in a sense, unstoppable, at least for the foreseeable future, and that demand, in turn, has let the price continue to go up, as China and India have demanded vastly more energy resources than they have in the past. You add that to insecurity in the Persian Gulf and in Iraq, and it explains in large part why the price of oil is now at the near the $78 a barrel mark.
You have been talking about alternative ways of looking at foreign policy, where military solutions are de-emphasized and political solutions are brought to the fore. Tell us more about your thinking on this.
Well, in the particular context of energy, let's take one step back and sort of ask, what happens to governments when they discover that they have vast energy wealth? And the answer has been universally, with one exception, bad. The exception, of course, is Norway, and there's a lot of reasons that Norway doesn't fit into the rest of the sort of examples. Look at the countries that have recently discovered huge energy resources. We could start with Russia. It's always had resources, but only in the last decade has it really been able to start extracting them. And what's happened is Russia has become hugely wealthy. One walks down the streets of Moscow, and you see more glaring signs of wealth than anywhere else in the world today. But with that wealth, President Putin has essentially been able to buy off his own people. In other words, he's offered them wealth from oil resources, but in exchange said, you have to support me, President Putin, and you have to be willing to accept compromises in areas such as freedom of speech and freedom of belief and conscience, and had drastically limited human rights practices, but has been able to co-opt, in a sense, his population with the wealth payoffs from oil.
I have a question for you, Bill, about that. What does that actually look like for the average Russian citizen? What kind of payoffs are they experiencing?
They are experiencing extraordinarily rapid increase in standards of living for, say, the top 10% of Russian society. And those are really the only 10% that matters to Putin. Those are the elites in places like Moscow and Petersburg, and even the upper middle class in those countries where wealth has trickled down. So it means that suddenly you have much greater incomes, much greater access to luxury goods, and a much higher standard of living, when you can perhaps buy yourself a summer house in the south of France or a home in London, and commute on business class flights between Moscow and those places and live a very, very good, rich life. But the quid pro quo for that is to accept the power of the Russian government and not to question it. And those who do question it, like the former head of Yukos, Mikhail Khodorkovsky — Yukos was then the Russia's largest oil company, and Khodorkovsky was the richest man in Russia — who tried to challenge Putin's preeminence, found himself in jail, looking at spending the rest of his life behind bars. So that's the kind of trade-off that you see in a lot of countries which have energy resources. Another example is Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez has, with Venezuela's newfound energy resources, been able to give his people lots of benefits, better health and education, for example. But the quid pro quo has been not to criticize Chavez and to accept him exercising much greater political power and restrictions on some fundamental human rights.
I think there's a contrast here that should be pointed out, which is that if Putin's strategy is to allay the top 10%, Chavez is really the poor whom he is serving with the policies that come from and the wealth that comes from their oil resources.
Absolutely. Putin's an elitist, in a sense. His goal is to buy off the Russian elites. Chavez is a populist, and so his goal is to, in a sense, buy off the poor, and in the process, yes, the poor become much better off. But again, the deal, in a sense, is that you accept the extraordinary power of the state. And Chavez has kicked out a number of foreign energy companies and increased the percentage share that the domestic Venezuelan oil companies get where there are joint ventures, and so been able to offer his people much more in terms of economic benefit. But again, that comes at the cost on the human rights and democracy indicators.
So the basic overarching point here is that when countries discover and use their riches in fossil fuels, unwanted things happen.
Yeah, unwanted things happen in the sense that those governments tend to become much less accountable and often much more domineering. And we've certainly seen that in Russia, where, you know, Russia now is thinking of itself not as a military power. Its military can't win a bloody, ugly civil war in Chechnya, but as an energy power that can clamp down on the European Union when it wants to, by threatening to shut off the energy supply lines. The other place to think about what happens when countries get energy wealth is Africa. And what we've seen with African states is a little different, which is a vast amount of corruption. That suddenly, if $78 a barrel oil is flowing out of the ground in a country like Equatorial Guinea in Africa or Nigeria, a very small elite is able to profit a great deal. Take Angola, for example. There are approximately 300,000 Angolans who now have offshore accounts in Europe or in, you know, the Cayman Islands, for example. Where is the money in those accounts coming from? It's coming out of the oil wealth, but the vast number of Angolans are no better off for it. So we do see this trend of bad governance and corruption when there's oil resources coming out of the ground. What does that all mean for American foreign policy? Well, I think it means we have to rethink how we deal with countries that have vast oil resources. Currently, our approach has been to say that what we want is a number of different suppliers so that we're not dependent on any particular supplier. So we look at negotiating contracts with different countries and making sure militarily that the countries that do have vast oil resources either like us, are afraid not to like us, or that the oil pipelines are going through countries that we like. And part of what I am arguing in a forthcoming policy paper is that instead we need to be thinking about good governance in these countries. That means thinking about how do we make sure that the countries that we're dealing with, despite having vast oil resources, have accountable, popular governments. Because first of all, we would be much better off dealing with popular, accountable governments than with either corrupt dictators or with countries in the midst of a civil war like that in Iraq. Popular accountable governance make sure that the benefits of energy resources go to their own people, and also tend, because of the checks and balances on them domestically, to sell oil on the open market. And it is a much more free and open system, and in the end of the day is much better to us than having to worry about whether tomorrow Putin, Chavez, or the Saud family want to sell us oil. And what that means for us in our foreign policy, I think it means putting our money where our mouth is to an extent. We have for a long time talked about the need for good governments and popular accountable governments, but when the push comes to shove, we still offer to sell the Saudis $20 billion in arms. And I think what we need to do as the United States is to wake up and say no. We need to make it a foreign policy priority to pressure states, even those that have energy resources, toward the kinds of popular and accountable government that can meet our own values and our own morality, but also that are going to be more reliable suppliers for us in the long term.
Well, you're bringing up a number of things here, and one is that good governance in a foreign country makes for stability. But what about our own governance? I mean, when you talk about our values, our morals, I think there's an open question there in terms of how we treat our own population and how we treat other countries. I mean, I wouldn't just give us a puppy dogs and rainbows seal of approval here.
Absolutely. There's a huge disconnect between what I would describe as some fundamental American values and the way our government often behaves. We could think hard and debate, and I think the country needs to do this, what our values really are in foreign policy. But I think that we can, if we look back historically, we can identify a number of them. There's an excellent new book by Anne-Marie Slaughter professor who's the dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, called... I'm blanking on the name, it'll come to me in a moment, but she talks about the values inherent in American foreign policy and identifies things such as fundamental freedom, economic advancement, and humility. Humility is something that was very much part of America's early foreign policy. If one looks, say, at President Washington's farewell address to Congress, it's all about humility. Or even the famous City Upon a Hill speech with the founding of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It's about the rest of the world's eyes being on us, but us having to respond in a humble way. And so I think that's one of the values that's been totally lost in American foreign policy.
I was going to say,
desperately needs to be reintegrated.
Right. I mean, we're talking about the 18th century.
Yes, but we're talking about, I think, what America is founded on and based on, and it's time, I think, that those values get reintegrated in a way that we don't just say to the world, oh, we're going to attack you if we don't like where things are, but say, no, we're going to talk with you, we do have our goals, and we should still push for them, but that we can achieve much more using soft power and dialogue than we can, dropping cluster bombs.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White, professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. What you're saying sounds wonderful and something to be striven for. And at the same time, when we talk about, for example, multi-billion-dollar arms sales to Saudi Arabia, at this point in our country's history, I think it would probably be safe to say that the arms manufacturers who want to sell these arms have more power than the citizens of the country.
Absolutely, they do. It is important to note that on many arms exports, there is a congressional control over it. In other words, that sale of $20 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia can only proceed if Congress does not pass a resolution prohibiting it within 60 days. So it's a sort of negative control power that Congress has in that case.
Does that power ever get used?
Sorry?
Does that power ever get used?
It gets used occasionally. It has not yet been used with respect to the Saudi arms sale, but I would not be at all surprised if the Democratic-led Congress blocks that sale to Saudi Arabia because it is so politically politically volatile, and particularly volatile given Israeli interests in the region. So I'm guessing that Congress may well use that threat with respect to that arms sale. But at the end of the day, you're right to say that the oil lobby and the arms lobby have a great deal of power. And one of the things that needs to change in government is the degree to which those industries have lobbying power over the Congress, often to the detriment of global well-being. Yes, there are some key allies that we ought to be, selling arms to. I don't think anyone will complain too much if we want to sell an aircraft carrier to the British. But when we start talking about selling small arms, the 190,000 small arms we lost in Iraq, or other technologies to Saudi Arabia that just leads to a regional arms race, we really need to be thinking about whether we are better off as a country and more secure as a country for doing so. And I think the answer is probably not.
Speaking of global well-being, I just can't let this conversation go on without talking about the problem inherent in this whole conversation, which is that if our energy security is dependent on fossil fuels that turn into essentially carbon dioxide, we have no global security to speak of in the first place, global warming being the biggest problem that we're facing, and not only in terms of our own health, but in terms of terrorism, the economy, and everything else.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100% that we need to be not just thinking about how we change our own energy use toward renewable resources, but how we can take the lead in a global sense in making sure other countries also move in that direction. I still think we need to re-examine our own foreign policy of energy security and start thinking about better governance in those areas, because it's not going to happen overnight, and other countries are going to take a long time before they find themselves in a fully renewable energy situation. But you're right. These two things have to go side by side. And in fact, one of the best ways for us to be able to put pressure on bad governments that have energy resources is if we have a credible threat to alternative sources of energy. If we only need to buy half as much oil because the other half of our energy is being provided by renewable resources, we can suddenly pick and choose. We can say, let's buy from Norway, a country that does very, very good things with its energy wealth. Or let's say to countries, we'll only buy from you if you make sure that your energy proceeds actually benefit your people and don't lead to corrupt governance.
Let's look at some of the Democratic frontrunners, and you were going to tell us what is their point of view, what are their plans, what is their rhetoric about energy security for the United States?
So let's talk at least about the sort of four leading candidates for the Democratic nomination. Senator Clinton, Governor Richardson, Senator Edwards, and Senator Obama, and all of them have put forward energy strategies. They all are actually quite similar in what they're saying. They first of all say that reducing America's foreign energy dependence is critical, and a move toward renewable resources is critical. However, none of them go anywhere near far enough, given the concerns you just raised. Let me give you some examples. Senator Clinton is calling for a 20% move to renewable resources by the year 2020. So that we would be using only 20% of our energy would come from renewable sources. And she has proposed a $50 billion strategic energy fund to help us move in that direction. Senator Richardson has gone somewhat further and called for a 30% move to renewable energy by 2020. And he has talked about a 90% cut in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2020. He proposes to achieve that both by cleaner technologies and by use of other resources. Senator Edwards has also talked about this. He goes perhaps the least distance, calling only for a 15% reduction in greenhouse gases, but he does talk about the need for a new climate regulation treaty. Senator Obama echoes Senator Clinton with a goal of a 20% reduction in fossil fuel use and a move to 20% renewables by 2020. He has actually authored with Senator Lugar an energy bill to promote, for example, hybrid cars, which is sort of a central piece of his energy platform. So on the energy scoreboard, I have to actually give Senator Richardson the highest marks and Senator Edwards probably the lowest marks, and say that none of them go far enough in setting targets in this area.
Having done a series last year on global warming on this program, and the numbers are getting more dire rather than less as time goes by, scientists themselves are saying that a 70 to 80% decrease in greenhouse gas emissions within the next 10 years is absolutely necessary to avert the most drastic consequences of global warming.
Hopefully, our Democratic candidates will wake up and hear that. at the moment, they are not going far enough. Probably the reason they're not going far enough is, you know, that they're worried about the economic consequences of some of these proposals. But I think it's time we start putting some pressure on them to be far more aggressive in this area. The other thing I think that's important to think about, though, when we talk about both the need for an 80% reduction that you just talked about and the potential, you know, next president, is that an 80% U.S. reduction does essentially very little good, because if the Chinese, the Indians, the Brazilians, and others don't also reduce their energy uses, we all suffer the same fate. And so what I think is critical is making sure that we have a dual strategy. One is taking the lead in reducing these energy pollution ourselves, but also really championing a global climate treaty that goes much, much farther than the Kyoto Treaty does. And Senator Obama has recognized in his foreign policy the need to do that. Senator Richardson has also talked about the need for, you know, a new climate treaty. So I think we have to take both steps at the same time, because if the U.S. does it alone, that doesn't stop the global warming phenomenon.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White. What do these candidates, the Democratic frontrunners, have to say about the question of Iraq, what to do, how to get out, whether to get out, and so on?
Well, it's really interesting to line the four of them up and sort of see where they differ. And on Iraq, in fact, they all come out in more or less the same place. Let's start with Hillary Clinton. Her goal, first of all, is to deauthorize the war. Note that this is the same war that she authorized 5 years ago as a senator, but to deauthorize it and revoke the president's permission to continue fighting, and to begin a process of withdrawing American troops, in which she hopes that that will pressure the Iraqi government to get serious about bringing about a political solution. Senator Edwards talks about a much more immediate withdrawal of 40,000 troops and a full withdrawal within 1 year. Senator Clinton's been more reluctant to put a time frame on it. And Edwards has talked a lot about the need to engage with both Iran and Syria going forward. Senator Obama called for a redeployment of U.S. troops beginning in May of this year, a date that's already passed, but a removal of all combat brigades by March 2008, and also a much more active dialogue with Iran's neighbors to try to promote a solution. On Iraq, I have to say, again, that it is, in fact, Governor Richardson who probably puts forward the most clear plan for what needs to be done. He, too, calls for a deauthorization of the war, a war that he, of course, didn't vote to authorize, nor did Senator Obama vote to authorize it. Governor Richardson calls for all U.S. troops to come out of Iraq within 6 months and has a fairly detailed plan to talk about reconciliation through working with Iraq's neighbors, a global reconstruction fund to try to help rebuild Iraq. But essentially, all of them are calling for a withdrawal of U.S. troops. The differences tend to be on how soon and how many, and how many troops will be left in Iraq at the end of the day. Both Senator Edwards and Governor Richardson are calling really for a full withdrawal. Senator Clinton would leave some troops in place. Senator Obama would leave some troops in place for a slightly longer period of time, but eventually, again, leading to a full withdrawal. I think part of the reason that all the Democrats have essentially the same view on this is that there are no good solutions in Iraq today. We have gotten into such a dangerous and bad position that there is very little hope for a military presence in Iraq to do much good going forward.
The withdrawal of soldiers, does that mean also from the very massive military bases that we've constructed in Iraq?
It would mean, well, Senator Clinton would say to, that she would like to leave at least some U.S. soldiers in those bases for some period of time. And I think that most of the candidates would recognize that deployment or redeployment will be a phased process. So I don't think we're going to wake up one day and see zero American troops in Iraq. But that I think for all of them, it will be a very minimal number, and both Governor Richardson, Governor Richardson certainly, and Senator Edwards have talked about, moving towards zero U.S. troops in Iraq as the ultimate goal.
Tell us about these four candidates and their views about foreign policy in general.
So let's sort of take them again, starting with Senator Clinton. She has, of course, been in the White House as First Lady and in the Senate for, nearly, 8 years almost now, 7 years now. And so she has a great deal of experience, which is one of the things that she emphasizes. But at the same time, experience perhaps means that she is more locked into the status quo of American foreign policy. Her foreign policy aides tend to be people who have been in the White House, in the State Department for a considerable time under Clinton, under Bill Clinton, she talks about a need to restore America's standing in the world as a key goal, but she is perhaps more conservative in terms of not changing things very much. She has said that she won't directly negotiate with the countries that we have most problems with, such as Iran and North Korea, until a series of preconditions are met. So I think with Senator Clinton, what we're likely to get is a very stable hand at running American foreign policy, but one that reflects the foreign policy of where we have been in the past to a greater degree.
Well, where we have been in the where we've been
In
the past in terms of the neoconservative of her predecessor, if she were to be.
Well, not the neoconservatism of the Bush administration, but where we've been in the past in terms of
Bill
Clinton. President Clinton's foreign policy, which was one that wasn't neoconservative in a sense, but promoted global stability and was largely a kind of had moved beyond the sort of realism of the likes of Henry Kissinger to think about interests such as human rights and so forth, but that was not going to be a break with the past in any significant way. Certainly, Senator Clinton would change the tone of American foreign policy, but the fundamentals, I think, would probably remain somewhat similar to what they were under Bill Clinton.
And so you were about to talk about Senator Edwards.
Yeah, Senator Edwards perhaps has the least foreign policy experience of any of the major candidates, and it's the least important part of his campaign. Most of what he talks about is the need to get the United States out of Iraq and out of Iraq as soon as possible. The rest of his foreign policy is perhaps slightly less developed. One of the things he does talk about a good deal, however, is the need to deal with humanitarian crises such as Darfur and the situation in northern Uganda. He has made some interesting statements on Iran, calling for more direct talks with the Iranian government and the need to rebuild American alliances in order to promote those discussions. I think an Edwards foreign policy would be more populist, perhaps, than any of the other candidates, more in the sense of thinking about individuals in many of these countries. I think he would push for greater foreign aid and greater commitment to the humanitarian situation. But his foreign policy speeches have been fewer and farther between, in part because his campaign has largely focused on domestic issues.
We've got just a couple of minutes left, but let's talk about Obama and Richardson.
Yeah, so with respect to Governor Richardson, he also has a great deal of foreign policy experience, which he got during the Clinton administration and then subsequently in a lot of sort of more private diplomacy. he has talked about the need to repair alliances as a key goal and to establish a new multilateralism, to recognize the importance of international law and international institutions. He himself was at the United Nations for a while, and he's also talked urgently about the need to fight poverty. So I think Governor Richardson would give us a very strong multilateral foreign policy in the experience of having dealt with a lot of these difficult countries before. I think Senator Obama offers the most exciting new foreign policy. He talks about the need for a new American leadership led by both word and example, a goal of transforming the military, a very clear program to stop the spread of weapons of mass destruction, a new dialogue. He has said that he is willing to have direct talks with the leaders of states that we don't like very much without preconditions, because he agrees that you get more done if you do talk than if you don't. He gave a speech on August 1st at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington where he laid out a very bold set of ideas in terms of aid to try to change the educational curriculums in countries like Pakistan, but at the same time expressed a willingness, which he's been criticized for, to use the military if the Pakistani government can't deal with the terrorist threats that are now seem to be being harbored in North Pakistan. But I think what Obama offers more than anything else is new ideas and a new ability to break through the political divides and old thinking in foreign policy. He offers a really new platform, a new face, also new coalitions of support within the United States that might well let him break through some of the traditional constraints that American politicians have found. So I think that Senator Obama really offers the most exciting and potentially transformative vision in American foreign policy. And if I were him, I would say that the first day in office that one ought to do three things. First, sign up to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court that President Bush took us out of as a symbol of commitment that we're willing to restrain ourselves from committing war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. Second, begin the process of championing a new global energy treaty, a treaty that would deal with the energy problems we've talked to and tell the world that we're serious about taking global leadership here. And third, begin an immediate process of getting out of Iraq and solving that problem. But I think those would be both symbolic and meaningful ways of transforming American foreign policy for whichever of these four people hopefully becomes our next president.
Bill Birkwhite, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's always a pleasure. Have a good morning.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks for Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.
It's Ron Blumberg, just the voice in the crowd. All right, I don't want this to go any further than, say, Taos. But sometimes at night, not every night, mind you, maybe three nights a week, four if I really need a fix, I get myself really comfortable and watch, oh God, I don't know how to say this. I watch Antiques Roadshow. Exciting life I'm living, don't you think? I used to be a wild, exciting, adventurous guy. Oh, wait a minute. That was Robert Downey Jr. Anyhow, there I am, sitting in front of my gigantic new flat-screen, high-definition TV, watching a set of porcelain plates. Of course, the dialogue is very snappy. It belonged to my great aunt. It was given to her by her great aunt, and it's been in our closet for 40 years. Not my great aunt, the plates, and I always wondered what it might be worth. The appraiser always says, well, let's turn it over and see if it's signed. Of course, the seductive part of the show is trying to guess what those objects are worth. So you say 20 years ago you bought this sewing box at a flea market for $5.35. Well, I would estimate its value today at $65,000 to $75,000. Of course, cynic that I am, I always think, okay, let's see her get $65,000 to $70,000. They never managed to show us that part. And yet, I do secretly wonder what that gold-plated harmonica that my uncle left me is worth. It's not exactly signed, but there is a marking on it. Let me see what it says. Oh, made in Taiwan. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
You can hear Ron every Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, on Thursdays after the noon news, and Saturdays following Bob Edwards.